We're back again. You showed up again, so it must not have scared you away. I'm glad to see you all. Tonight's presentation is we're going to cover some similar ground as we did last week, but some more. We'll get deeper into it, and we'll get closer to beginning to unpack and discern some of the things that we talked about last week. But first, I'll Reader Thomas, Dr. Bookman, some more deadly humor. Whilst on the bus, Bob had a near-death experience. I'm putting this in here because one of you told someone that I know well and love dearly, my wife, that you appreciated the every once in a while the lightheartedness of this, since we're getting into such heavy subjects. So Bookman has supplied me with a lot of that. So tonight what we're going to start off with is looking at the second book that we talked about as our source material for last week, Evidence of the Afterlife, which is the largest scientific study to date of near-death experiences ever conducted. But before we do that, we're blessed. Are you sure you're up for it? We're blessed. We have a special opportunity tonight. Norman Lycus, Subdeacon Michael's youngest brother. It's hard to tell. How far apart are you guys? I mean, it's 3 years? 4?
6 years.
6 years. Wow, so you were young. Boy, The Lycus has found the fountain of youth, I think. You need to tell us where it is. Unless it's limited supply, then you keep it for yourself. A few years ago, Norman had a very serious incident in his life. What year was that?
2004.
And I remember talking to you a little bit about it. I don't want to steal any of your thunder. You can go on and come up. I'm going to have you. You were out in the pasture, right? Wearing tennis shoes, not something that a self-respecting Nebraskan should ever admit in public, and felt a little prick on your ankle or your leg?
My ankle.
On your ankle. And I'll let him take it from there.
The prick that I felt was the bite of a rattlesnake, and it bit me 3 times. I was slow reacting. I actually thought it was a piece of barbed wire. There was a lot of things that transpired, and it's kind of a long story, but I drove myself to the house. Didn't want to call 911 yet because I am an EMT and a fireman. My pager was in the house. My wife and kids were in the house. So I waited till I got back to the house to call.
Can I interrupt here? All medical professionals are the same, aren't they?
That's true. That's true.
Do as I say and not as I do.
And finally, the Flight for Life came. There was construction between Curtis and North Platte. I live in Curtis, Nebraska, by the way. And there was construction in 3 different spots, so they flew me to North Platte, which, thank God, there was the helicopter in McCook that could fly me. Took 8 minutes to get from Curtis to North Platte, at which time, when they wheeled me in the operating room, coincidence, the ER doctor was the doctor who was my mother's doctor when I was born. And of course I had the air mask on, and he goes, "Sir, what's your name?" And I, "Dr. Weston, it's me, Norm." And he stood up and hit the first words out of his mouth was, "People, I brought this man into the world. I am not taking him out." And at that time the venom was pretty severe within me.
It was a baby rattler, right?
It was about 2 foot long. It was a smaller one, but I'd stepped on it, and you know, I guess he was mad. But when the venom started in, I started having full body contractions. And, I mean, it was as severe can get. Ladies, I know what you go through during childbirth. I really do. It was from head to toe. I lost all control of my bowels. I mean, when the contractions came, and the pain was very severe. There was one point. At one point, I thought to myself, "I can't take this anymore." It was at that point that God intervened. If I get emotional, I'm sorry, but it's still. It was the best, worst thing that ever could happen to a human being. And when I say that, the pain was unbearable. When I realized I couldn't take it anymore, God lifted my soul from my body. Some people say, well, it was the drugs. No, it wasn't. I know it wasn't. Because that's just not the way it works. The feeling that I got, hug a loved one, multiply that times a million, and you still can't envision the love that I was feeling, the comfort that I was feeling at that point in time. It was terrific. And the reason I know it was God, because I had lost a good friend a couple weeks earlier, and my wife was in the ER, and as I was, my soul was lifting out of my body, I looked over at my wife, and Bob Phillips said, "Norm, everything's going to be just fine." And I knew what he was talking about. And it's not something that, you know, after when I finally came to a few hours later, that I thought, oh, I was dreaming it, because it was not a dream. It's not something that, oh, I imagined it, because I did not imagine it. When my mom died a couple years ago, I somewhat envied her, because at the moment of death, I knew what had happened with her. Her soul was held in God's hands. When I have friends die now, I'm sad to see them go, because I want to say something more to them. But in a way, I'm envious, because I know at that time what they experienced, their soul was lifted in God's hands. There is the God that is going to comfort you at the time of death. I am not afraid to die. I don't want to die. But I am not afraid to die, because I know what's going to happen. My soul is going to be lifted into heaven. And you, it's just, I want so bad for the people that I tell this to feel the love that I felt at that moment. And I can't. I cannot tell you, you know, everybody's heard the story of the tracks in the sand. Two tracks, and then there was one. And the guy asked God, you know, why, when times got tough. Well, you know, that's exactly what it was. When times got so tough for me on that ER table, there was one track, because he was bearing my pain. He was not going to let me hurt anymore. My body might have been hurting, but my soul was not going to hurt anymore. And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. Thank you, Bob.
And
And doesn't that go right along with what we were talking about last week, what we're going to talk about this week? Beautiful. Now, so did you, when your soul left your body, no pain?
No pain.
Didn't feel pain. You could still see, you could still sense your wife, those around you. Did you see yourself? Did you see your own body?
I did not see my body, but I could feel them working on it.
Right. Okay. Well, great. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is, and is one of the reasons I want us to talk in this course, while we're talking about this, is that there are things that, as Christians, we can definitely affirm. We're going to get into it more next week a little bit. We'll get into it at the end of this week. There are some things that when the near-death experience goes further in what some people are reporting, or at least what the experts who haven't had near-death experiences themselves but are studying them, what they tell us, there's some things that need discernment. But what we can say to Norman is exactly what he said to us, affirming that what happened to him was from God and it was real. Absolutely real. Falls along with exactly what we've been talking about. So, evidence of the afterlife. The science of near-death experiences by Jeffrey Long, MD. Dr. Long is a radiation oncologist by profession with a background in statistical analysis. He himself was, like most doctors, was a secular non-believer before his research. He heard the story, a story much like Norman shared with us, a friend of a colleague, the wife of a colleague of his, that set him thinking. And years later, he began to research this. And through his research, he is now a bold proponent of the truth of near-death experiences and of the afterlife. And he founded Near-Death Experience Research Foundation in 1998. Interest he first had this was in the mid-80s, if I'm remembering the book right, but he founded this, he was thinking about it a lot, but he founded this in 1998 with the advent of the internet. And so NDERF is, it's a website that is compiling all these different, and you can go to it, Norman, and share your experience. It's www.nderf.org. At least at the time of the book was published, Evidence of the Afterlife, in 2010, based on the largest study of near-death experiences ever undertaken, using the internet and an extensive questionnaire through this research website. So he's getting near-death experiences from all around the world, different languages. If people want to have them for public viewing, they can say so. And as of 2010, there are over 1,300 of these on this website. Okay? It is, as I said, ongoing and worldwide. And it is statistical. I don't understand statistics, but he says it's statistical analysis of individual near-death experiences in multiple languages. So one of the things they have now is volunteers who are receiving something in German or Japanese or Hindi or whatever, and they get someone to translate these into English. And then I think there's some translation work back into the other language as well. As I said, it's based on 1,300 reported near-death experiences, and these are examined and cross-examined and weeds out the fake ones. And he said very, 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 very few fake ones. Okay? You can go on the website and read these. You can read a lot of them if you want. Research indicates that as many as 5% of people have had near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. Like I mentioned last time, we have Norman, a very striking one. Another person in our parish has had one after a serious surgery. There's probably more out there. Dr. Long also reports significant prejudice from the medical and scientific community against the truth and validity of near-death experiences. Has you come across any of that? Like when you tell a doctor and they say, "Well, that's the drugs."
I have not physicians, but lay people. I have, you know, no. you know, and they've said it's the drugs. And I said,
right,
believe me if you want, don't believe me if you want.
Right.
It is your belief.
Right.
I know what I know.
Absolutely. So, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the criticisms of near-death experiences tonight. While I was reading Evidence of the Afterlife, went to my doctor, had an appointment, taking a book to read along, long wait. I love my doctor. He's a good doctor. A man of spirituality, but not a believer in God or anything like that. He practices some form of meditation. And, you know, I'm thinking, this is another doctor. So, you know, maybe we could strike up a conversation. We have interesting conversations every once in a while. And I said, have you seen this book, Proof of the Evidence of the Afterlife? It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's by a radiation oncologist, a medical doctor. And he said, well, you know, the mind is an interesting thing. But as a doctor, as a physician, Dr. Long refutes the common challenges offered by near-death experience critics. One of the disputes, we'll talk a little bit about them now, hallucinations caused by the lack of oxygen, hypoxia, that as someone is dying, going through trauma, I believe it is 10 to 20 seconds after the heart stops, that the blood and the blood flow stops in the brain, that the EEG, the electrical activity in the brain, goes flat very quickly. So some have said, well, it's hallucinations caused by hypoxia, by lack of oxygen to the brain. Others have said it's electrical misfirings causing random memories, that as the brain shuts down and the brain kind of shuts down from the outside inward, there's random electrical activity going on, and that we may be firing off random memories as our brain is dying and coming to us. And so those who are revived will remember those. Or others will say that those who've experienced near-death experiences are not actually dead. They're close to death, but they seem to be dead, but they're not dead. The problem with all of these is, from a medical point of view, and others, Dr. Long goes into others and refutes them, they're not valid. They're not valid. Because what Norman described to us is cogent, it's cohesive, it's not random memories firing off, it's not hallucination, because it's a cohesive. He could stand up here, he could tell us the narrative, it makes complete sense to us. Also the feelings that's going on, the feeling of great love, the feeling of comfort. We described that last time when the soul is separated from the body. It feels this natural state. And as we're going to talk a little bit about next week, at least I believe that the noetic part, the spiritual part of the soul, then much more easily perceives what the saints, and even what some of us, have experienced in little bits and pieces of the love, the majesty that God has for all the universe, for us, the unimaginable, exactly like he described it. Words cannot describe spiritual experiences. Words cannot describe, as St. Paul says, when he is caught up to the third heaven, words are not lawful. There's no human concepts, no human words can describe this experience of the love of God. And also maybe even the experience of the natural state of the soul as it's separated from the body.
When I was an intern rotating on neurosurgery, I got into a discussion with my attending about how much function brain does have. And we got on the subject of decapitation. Mm-hmm. And there actually is a French physician who, at the time of the revolution, you know, mm-hmm. people who were on the list to be guillotined, mm-hmm. he visited with beforehand, and at the time of their decapitation was going to yell a command, either to yell, you know, right or left, to see if they're, you know, and have their eyes track mm-hmm. to that direction. And found that people actually have the capacity to hear and to understand after decapitation as they look to the right or left. Now, reproducing that would be difficult, but...
And like we said, 10 to 20 seconds. Absolutely. But you get in a minute, you get in 2 minutes, the brain's gone, the cell death is already happening. And what people come back with is cogent narratives. It makes sense. It fits together. It's not random. One of the other things that's one of the other criticisms to say, well, this isn't really happening, comes with chest compressions. That if someone's being given CPR, there's still blood flowing to the brain, and therefore the brain could produce some of these sensations, could fake out. Some will say it's a comfort mechanism. But the people who have actually come back to consciousness during the midst of chest compressions describe a frightful experience, incredible amounts of pain, and it's very disjointed and disconnected. So that's one of the things that we'll get into the lines of evidence. So the brain does last for a little while, but not long. 10 to 20 seconds. Once the brain, the oxygen and the blood stop flowing to the brain, any kind of cogent, detailed, complex, subtle, emotional, spiritual experience, that's not what the brain is going to be able to put together. Does that make sense? Okay. So, let's just talk about it. He modifies a little bit, slightly, the model for the near-death experience that we talked about last time. It's a little bit simpler. I like it a little better. One, out-of-body experience, separation of the consciousness from the physical body. Two, heightened senses. And Norman or anyone, at any time, if you want to add your two cents, please do so. Do you experience heightened senses? Not everyone describes that.
No.
Okay. And it's more the longer-term near-death experiences. Intense, generally positive feelings or emotions. Okay. If this lasts a while longer, passing into or through a tunnel, that perception. No?
No, I did not. I did not see lights.
Right. And one of the things in the... there's 12 of these. We'll just go through them quick. These are going further along into the experience, encountering a mystical or brilliant light, encountering other beings, either mystical beings or deceased relatives or friends. Yes. A sense of alteration of time or space. People aren't really sure how long it takes. It seems a long time and maybe they're not gone along, or it seems very quickly and they've been gone a long time. A life review. We talked about that. Seeing your life flash before your eyes, all the events of your life in detail. Encountering another world or heavenly realm. Encountering or learning special knowledge. Encountering a boundary or barrier. And then a return to the body, either voluntary or involuntary. Now, remember that what the near-death experience researchers are doing is talking to many people. And some people may have a shorter near-death experience, kind of, maybe like Norman's. Or maybe some others are even shorter. Some may have a longer one. We're going to read one, a first-hand account from a Russian man, and he was dead for 36 hours. We'll do that in the coming weeks. But what they're doing is talking to people, and these are the things that happen. Not all of these happen to everyone, but some of them happen to everyone, if that makes sense. So maybe someone has two or three. If it's a longer one, they may have four, five, or six. No one has all of these, but these are common things that people are reporting. Okay. The neat thing about evidence of the afterlife, thus the title, is that... Dr. Long says there are 9 lines of statistical proof for the validity of near-death experiences. One of these is lucid death. People remain conscious at times when consciousness should be scientifically impossible. unconscious states near death or after clinical death, after the heart has stopped, but they can recount experiences they observed. These experiences are highly organized and lucid, unlike hallucinations or dreams. Hallucinations and dreams caused by drugs, caused by trauma, are disjointed. They're chaotic. They are not lucid. They don't make sense. Okay? During this time, near-death experiences often report heightened senses, especially sight. We're not going to read it. We don't have time, but you can read it later. The case of Pam Reynolds, a well-known case of near-death experience, a lucid death, or it could fit in under one of the other categories as well. She's going in to actually induce death to fix a brain aneurysm. Her eyes are taped shut. For reasons to monitor her brain, they have earplugs in her ears producing a constant sound at 100 decibels to measure brain activity. So she can't, I mean, that's the as it says here, the sound of a passing train, that volume. She can't hear anything. And yet, as she's going through this, the moment of not greatest discomfort because she's under general anesthesia, but she has an out-of-body experience and then a near-death experience, and she can hear what's going on, what the doctors are talking about. She can see what they're doing. Her eyes are shut. And she's completely unconscious, and in fact, they stop her heart. They lower her temperature to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, so the aneurysm collapses and they can snip it off. Very dramatic. And yet she's reporting in detail to her doctors after she comes back things that they say, absolutely right. The arteries in one of her legs that they're trying to put the tube in, the flow through the blood thingy and whatever, one of the doctors says, her arteries are too small. They say, well, try the other leg. She reports that, and that happened. So, lucid death. Out of body, or it could go under out of body experience. Out of body, the second line of statistical proof. People report the experience of their consciousness leaving their physical bodies. During this time, things are observed that are later verified by others. Things that the person having the near-death experience should not have been conscious of or able to see. Often the near-death experiences report seeing their own body from outside, along with attempts at resuscitation and conversations taking place around the body. So Pam could fit under that too. I put her under there because she's under general anesthesia and they stop her heart. Okay, so, but either way, she could fit under those. And also, from last week's notes that are this week's notes, Maria, the caseworker, who read that from your notes last week, about the shoe outside on the ledge.
Oh, yeah.
Maria,
yeah.
Out of her body, there's a shoe. Can you go see the shoe? And the it's worn on the heel and the lace is under. Can you go see it? She's been taken into this room under cardiac arrest. She hasn't gotten up around and looked. And she has cardiac arrest while she's in the room again. Skeptical caseworker. She says, I want to know if this is real. There's a shoe out. The caseworker's like, whatever. Yes, there is. Exactly in detail as you described it. Blind sight. Matt asked about this last time. And we have in last week's portion of this week's notes the account of the woman born blind. People born blind or blind from infancy with no memory of sight, and as I talked about last week, no conception of sight, report having the sense of sight during their near-death experiences. Often these near-death experiencers understandably have difficulty verbally describing this experience because they have no conception of the sense of sight. They don't know what light is like. They don't know what color is like. It's not in their brain. And yet, when they come back, they describe something that seems, okay, yeah, that's what it's like to see. They experience sight. The senses work. While we're in the body, the soul uses the brain to think. It uses the eyes to see. It uses the ears to hear. But when it's separated from the body, it still perceives. It still feels. It still thinks better. This proves it. But when the blindness returns, when their consciousness returns to their physical body, they're blind again. So they can look forward to the moment of death with, get to see again. Impossibly conscious. Again, Pam Reynolds could fit under this. People report vivid out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences under general anesthesia. and medically impossible. In the very rare cases that a patient wakes up during general anesthesia due to too little anesthesia, which occurs, as Dr. Long says, in about 1 to 3 of 1,000 cases, and he says that doesn't mean you shouldn't go have general anesthesia. Do as I say, not as I do. He probably doesn't go under, I bet. The experience, when people do come out of this, which is what the critics are saying, well, they just didn't have enough anesthesia, so they're floating, they're seeing, you know. When the people who this actually happens to are waking up or still awake while they're sawing through their chest or doing, it's extremely fragmented, disjointed, painful, and frightening what they report. The exact opposite of what Norman shared and what those who experience near-death experiences share. Okay. Perfect playback, a real interesting one. The life review. People report experiencing a full review of their entire lifetime in extremely vivid detail. Now, some report their differences. Everyone has a different experience. Some report seeing only the highlights of their life. But this is a visual experience. We talked a little bit about this last week. But the person is also able to feel the emotions and see the outcomes of their own actions in the lives and hearts of those around them. When they're seeing, like I said, I punched Mark in a life review, playback, judgment, maybe. We'll talk about that. I will feel, not necessarily the pain, but the emotional reaction of my sin. Okay? It brings back long forgotten details that the person retains after the near-death experience is over. And very interesting, the amount of information and memories during this life review are experienced by the person. They see their life before their eyes. And this is usually a little bit later in the near-death experience. In a span far too short for the human brain to be capable of processing. So some people might say, some agnostics, atheists might say, that's just the brain shutting down and life is... You're going through a fast forward on every event of your life. But the speed of memory, of knowledge, of thought is limited to us by biochemical processes. Our neurons can only fire so fast. These experiences, every detail of your life, even just the highlights, which are many, 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 are happening in a period of perceived time too short for the human brain to be capable of processing all this information. And yet these people come back and they remember. Oh yeah, I remember where I left my... I remember that day that I lost my teddy bear and it was there. I don't even remember that I had a teddy bear. I can come back and know that. If I see that in this, retain these long forgotten memories. This life review often brings about positive changes in life and behavior. Family reunion. People report meeting dead relatives. The vast majority of near-death experiences report meeting dead loved ones. Over 95% report seeing someone who has passed. Okay? And this is different than when someone is having a hallucination or a dream caused by drugs, caused by trauma. Because when there are hallucinations and dreams, and the brain is kind of firing off randomly, the vast, vast majority of people who are hallucinating or dreaming report seeing living people. Because I'm interacting with you guys. If I have a hallucination tonight because of something, because of a drug interaction, whatever, I might remember you all, but I'm not going to be thinking about my dead relatives because you all were the last things in my mind. So that's another indication that this is a valid experience. Sometimes people report meeting a person they didn't know but felt close to, didn't know why, only to find out after their near-death experience that this person was a relative unknown to them. Dr. Eben met his sister. Colton Burpo met his sister, who didn't know he had. Several report seeing a loved one during a near-death experience they believe to be living. It's like, well, why am I seeing Grandpa? He's alive. Only to find out that at that same time, that person died while they were dying and having their experience. Okay, interesting. From the mouths of babes, children report experiencing many classic near-death points being too young to understand a near-death experience or to have much religious training. Colton Burpo, well, kind of. His dad's a pastor, so there's some things he's absorbing there. But sure, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds. One of the things that will be said is, you know, now that near-death experiences are more public because of Oprah and Life After Life by Raymond Moody, that people are conditioned, so they might come back and kind of make up this experience as their mind's trying to make sense the process of dying or trauma. But children, they don't know that. They couldn't list those 12 points for us. They don't know much about theology and heaven and the afterlife that they can put into words. They can put in some into words. So they're not pre-programmed. And yet young children's near-death experiences are statistically indistinguishable from the adults. Again, this is strong evidence that the near-death experiences are not forms of suggestion or learned behavior. Worldwide consistency. The researcher reports that the, quote, core near-death experience is the same worldwide, independent of cultural or religious differences. Seeming insignificant differences between different cultures' near-death experiences are alluded to in the evidence of the afterlife. So he's saying it's pretty much the same. There's a little bit of difference sometimes. However, another large, much earlier study we will look at later in the class points to more significant divergence in this area, and we need to look at it. We won't look at it this week, but he's saying whatever part of the world you're in, whatever your culture, religion, near-death experiences are very similar. Okay? Changed lives. People report that the near-death experience has significantly changed their life. People generally describe themselves as more loving and generous, less anxious, no longer afraid of death, more spiritual after their near-death experience. Studies also show that vivid dreams and hallucinations do not produce long-remembered memories or sensations, nor do they produce significant life changes. If I have a vivid hallucination because, you know, I don't know, doing something I'm not supposed to do, or I'm in the sweat lodge or something. I've been in the sweat lodge. Oh, boy. You're not hallucinating. You're thinking, I want to get out of here right now. My flesh is boiling. Alaska. Yeah, that's fun. Those hallucinations, vivid dreams caused by drugs. It's drugs, Norman. It's just drugs. They don't produce long-lasting memories. The memories fade, and they don't produce serious life changes. Okay. Some will report seemingly miraculous healing and recovery, often immediately following a near-death experience. Someone who's got a trauma, a cancer, they come back from a near-death experience, they're cancer-free. It's not that common. But he gets into this a little bit. Some report turning with borderline psychic abilities. Cue the Twilight Zone music. You don't have that. Okay. The ability to foretell things before they happen or to be able to read people and better understand others' emotional or mental state. Okay. So those are his 9 lines of evidence that he says even one of those is pretty conclusive proof that there is an afterlife, but 9 of them makes it statistically for sure. Okay? His own conclusions. Near-death experiences are virtually unanimous that the afterlife is for all of us. This is certainly consistent with their uniform description of the afterlife as a loving and inclusive realm, a realm for us all. Sounds nice. The greatest majority of near-death experiences believe they experience firsthand what lies beyond death. And you would certainly say that. And what they experience beyond death's door leaves many of them fearless when they think about death. For most near-death experiencers, their lack of fear of death is associated with the conviction that death is not final and that a wonderful afterlife is real. In its own way, the near-death experience has a healing effect on most people who have it. People who have a near-death experience may never fear death again, although they don't necessarily become more religious. Near-death experiences often state that they become more spiritual. And with that change comes a belief in the sacredness of life and a special knowledge that serves to guide them the rest of their lives. I want to step back here a little bit and say, yes, actually some people do become much more religious, devout. We'll talk about that later. But I also want to say, remember, these are the conclusions of the author. not the people themselves. Okay? This book has important implications for religion. The great religions have always spoken to the belief in God and an afterlife. The evidence of near-death experiences points to an afterlife and a universe guided by a vastly loving intelligence. Near-death experiences consistently reveal that death is not the end, but rather a transition to an afterlife. This is a profoundly inspiring thought for all of us, for our loved ones. And it is. For me personally, I'm showing more love to others now than before. I started my near-death experience studies. I face life with more courage and confidence. He says he's a better doctor. I cut that out. That's okay. Sorry. Sorry, Dr. Bookman. I believe near-death experiences really do bring back a piece of the afterlife. When near-death experiences share their remarkable experiences, I believe a piece of the afterlife in some mysterious way becomes available to us all. We're going to see what he thinks the important implications for religion are. This is an interview online, Skeptico. And the interviewer asked Dr. Long, I listened to this interview and also read the transcript. I've interviewed some Christian folks, us, very likable folks. I'm glad he likes us. And you get to the near-death experience data, and they get halfway there, only to the part that supports what they already believe. They say, yeah, I believe the near-death experiences show that there's a heaven and a God and Jesus is there. But please don't show me any data that would suggest there's anything different than that. And the author responds, yes. There's been a shift in that over the last few years. In fact, I was recently talking with Dr. Raymond Moody. We're going to visit him again. 1975, the culture-changing book, Life After Life, and I found out what he's been doing since, and this cat is out there. Woo! He's opened up a door, and it's crazy, and it's scary. He doesn't know it, but it is scary. I know what it is. He doesn't. Who first coined the term near-death experience in 1975 in his groundbreaking book, Life After Life. And he agrees. Both of us are seeing just over the last few years a real shift, a real openness, where people of all religious backgrounds to be a lot more open to the evidence of near-death experience than ever before. That's the transcript. Left out a word there. Now, atheists are still going to have a huge problem with it, but virtually everyone else seems to be very, very open. Remember that. Don't be so open your brains fall out, right? I think with anybody, again, speaking in general, if you've got a belief system that you absolutely know is correct, then any evidence to the contrary is certainly very difficult to hear, very difficult to accept, no matter how profound the evidence is. Natural observation. I think we see that over and over. Again, I think as time goes on, there are less and less people who rigidly are holding on to their belief systems, meaning faithful to their religious convictions. I think more and more people are inquiring. They're searchers. I think they're open to saying, what evidence is there in the world, both for and against an afterlife? It's people like that who have questions like that. Inquiring minds, openness, reasonable openness, that want to know about evidence. And that's where my book, Evidence of the Afterlife, comes in. Buy it! It's a New York Times bestseller. It is a good book.
It's
interesting. Time to take a break. What happens at those near-death conventions, really? This is me and my brush with death. This is me and my brush with death. Oh, boy. Conclusions of contemporary researchers regarding the near-death experience. Individual consciousness survives bodily death. After the soul leaves the body, it continues to think, feel, perceive, and communicate. The senses are heightened. The mind is incredibly sharp. The soul comes to feel comfort and peace and may perceive an ineffable light in which the soul describes sensing the love of God, the love of the Creator. They may not see that, but they feel it in their nous, in their spirit, okay? If the near-death experience lasts long enough, the soul usually meets other beings, often described as departed loved ones. The soul meets an indescript being of light. That means indescript, you know, not specific. Often believed by the near-death experiencer to be an angel or a spirit guide, or Jesus, or God? Depending on their background, I guess. If the near-death, or some of them are just being of light. If the near-death experience lasts long enough, a light review often occurs. This experience can be described best as psychologically therapeutic rather than, quote, judgmental. Meaning there is little or no relation between deeds done in life and consequences after death. Remember, conclusions of the researchers regarding near-death experience, not the people who are experiencing these things, but the researchers. Because we're talking about worldview again. Their conclusions, near-death experiences return with changed views of the afterlife that differ from religious teaching. Remember last week we talked about this? I thought I was going to be in heaven. What? Why am I? You know, it's beautiful. Norm believes in God. He believes in heaven. His soul left his body. But remember that one woman, her soul left her body, clinical death, and she's seeing her body. She's in the operating room. She's at peace, but she's like, wait a minute, where are those pearly gates? And it causes her to doubt her faith, her belief in heaven, in God, okay? At least in the way we know it. They come back more loving and compassionate, but there is little to no discussion of sin, repentance, or virtue. These, if you can tell, the parentheses are my editorial comments. All near-death experiences, while unique and individual, nonetheless point to a universal experience or a universal reality. Again, this is the conclusions of the researchers, not the people themselves. Contemporary near-death experiences give more accurate information about the afterlife than religious teachings. Natural observation prioritized over divine revelation. The evidence, he was talking about evidence in that last, the last screen we saw. People are open-minded, they want to know the evidence. And if you have a belief system and the evidence doesn't fit your belief system well, you better change it to fit the evidence. A very Western, scientific method, secular humanist worldview. Basically, the conclusions, a guaranteed positive experience of the afterlife for everyone. Hell is essentially absent from the researcher's worldview, though not from individual accounts, as we will see. And what does this lead us to? Traditional religious beliefs are ultimately unimportant, meaning Jesus, meaning sin, meaning hell. Okay? Everything experienced by the near-death experiencers can be accepted as not only real, but true. Understand the difference? It's real, but is it true? Well, they say, well, it's the evidence. The evidence is it's real. So it's true. Okay. Now, like I said, with an experience like Norman's, we can totally affirm and confirm absolutely everything that is real and true. But as we get further into some of these experiences, or how they're put together and understood by some of the researchers, we have to have some discernment. Their conclusions regarding religion. All of these patients experience a floating out of their physical bodies associated with a great sense of peace and wholeness. Most were aware of another person who helped them in their transition to another plane of existence. Most were greeted by loved ones who died before them or by a religious figure who was significant in their life and who coincided naturally to their own religious beliefs. We're going to get into this later, but we believe in Jesus. We believe in God. This is divine revelation. But when we go to India, the being of light or what they're seeing isn't, it's not necessarily Jesus showing up. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's Vishnu, Shiva, or Ganesh. Ooh, he has an elephant head. That'd be scary. Many persons have stressed how unlike their experiences were to what they were led to expect in the course of their religious training. Even those who previously had some traditional conviction about the nature of the afterlife world seemed to have moved away from it to some degree, following their own brushes with death. In place of this old model, heaven, hell, God who loves, but who lets us freely choose and have responsibility for what we choose in this life. In place of this model, many seem to have returned with a new model, we heard this last week, and a new understanding, a vision that features not unilateral judgment, and we disagree with that. We'll talk about God's judgment next week and what that is. It's not a mean God who's mad at us because we break the rules. It's not what it is. But rather cooperative development toward the ultimate end of self-realization. Our friend Raymond. And now evidence of the afterlife. Author, Dr. Long. The core near-death experience is the same all over the world. Whether it's the experience of a Hindu in India, a Muslim in Egypt, a Christian in the United States, the same core elements are present in all. Then he lists them, okay? Recognizing that people from all cultures experience similar events at the point of death may be a useful tool, sorry for that, typo, for cross-cultural understanding and dialogue. That makes near-death experiences an important spiritual concept that can help humanity strive towards world peace. I mean, I'm all for world peace, but the evidence that near-death experiences are basically the same the worldwide may be a reason to stop bickering over differences and instead focus on our similarities. That's great if you're talking about working together and respecting one another. But when you're talking about our religious beliefs, that we need to stop bickering over the differences and focus on the similarities. We need to stop bickering. But we can't hand over what we believe and what we receive from the apostles in Christ. What's wrong with this picture? Back to my favorite picture, Spaceship Earth. What's wrong with it? Back to our paradigms of observation that we talked about last week. Okay. The contemporary interpretation of near-death experiences. Remember, we have the geocentric model of the world, of the solar system, where everything centers around the Earth, even the sun is revolving around the Earth. And then we have the heliocentric, what's actually reality. The planets going around the sun. And these are two different worldviews, both of them based on evidence and observation. The evidence from our perceptions, the evidence from science, the proofs for this were very strong. I would have believed it back then. Absolutely. But there's more to than our senses can come up with. There's more informing how we put together the evidence. And so, what is the contemporary interpretation of near-death experiences by the researchers, by the book writers? I would put forward that it is a strange hybrid of secular humanism mixed with traditional Christianity. It is this and this put together in some kind of weird worldview, some kind of monstrosity. Okay. That doesn't really make sense. The contemporary interpretation of near-death experiences and traditional Christianity. What's there? Okay. The soul can exist independent of the body. Norman did not die on that tape, or did he?
No.
He didn't die. But at that experience, close to death, he was close to death. And God spared him. God lifted his soul out of his body. His soul left his body. But when his soul left his body didn't die. Okay? Most of the time it does, but his work isn't done. God's got all, Christ has got more for Norman to do in this life. He's got to figure that out. The soul can exist independent of the body. Absolutely. The soul survives physical death. And this includes consciousness, memory, sense perception, the ability to see and hear, and personality. Okay? Norman's soul is Norman's soul. Dr. Bookman's soul is Dr. Bookman's soul. When they depart from this life, they're still going to be, when they leave their body, they're still going to be Norman and Dr. Bookman. The soul is immortal. The soul lives without the body. Eternally. On this, there's a theological point, you know, is the soul immortal by nature? Is it immortal by the grace of God? Huh?
By grace.
By grace, we would say that. The soul exists as an immortal soul. It survives forever, not because that's its very nature, but because God wills it to be so. The soul is immortal as a gift from God. Okay? Everything's a gift from God. There is another realm beyond what our bodily senses perceive. Absolutely. That the contemporary near-death interpretations say that, so does Christianity. Other intelligent beings of a spiritual nature exist in this other realm. Absolutely. There is a guiding principle governing the universe and all of its inhabitants, both us and the spiritual beings out there, the angels. And this principle is personal in nature, meaning God. Something is keeping the universe together, keeping it going, organizing it, governing it. And it's personal. It's loving. It's God. Okay? It's not the Force in Star Wars. It's just the Force. In the words of Dr. Jeffrey Long, quote, "The universe is guided by a vastly loving intelligence," or in the words of someone a little wiser, the Apostle John, he says it a little bit more clearly, a little bit short. God is love. Okay? All right. Those things we can affirm. We'll talk a little bit more in depth next week about that. But then there's some things that are being told to us by Oprah, by these books, that I think we can see in the interpretation of the near-death experience a secular humanist influence. And first of all, I want to tackle this one. Dr. Long, quote, "The great religions have always spoken to the belief in God and an afterlife." Long. "The great religions do not teach this. In fact, it is unfair to tell a Buddhist or a Hindu that they believe in a God and an afterlife that's like a Christian God and a Christian. It's demeaning their religion because their religion doesn't teach it. At the base of Buddhist and Hindu teaching is a common supranatural reality, a reality that's above nature that also underlies everything. It's the foundation for everything. And this supreme reality is pure consciousness without attributes. It is awareness with no personality." I don't know if that, I mean, these are kind of heady concepts, but meaning it's impersonal. There's no God that cares about you, that loves you, that thinks about you. There's just a sea of awareness with no personality, with no mind. Okay? This is what Buddhism, and Buddhism is the Protestant Reformation of Hinduism. Any of you know, is that, yeah. Hinduism has thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of gods. Buddhism has no god. But when you get down to it, basically they believe the same thing. Okay. The human soul is of the same essence as this divine reality, this sea of nothingness but awareness with no personality, no personhood. Okay. The soul, so when they talk about the soul in Buddhism and Hinduism, they're not, when we say the soul, we mean the mind, the personality, memories. That's not what they mean. They mean the spark of divinity. The spark of this thing that's in everything. Okay? It's in the cow. We don't eat the cow. It's in the bug. Don't step on the bug. It's in you and me. Okay? So Christ and Buddha are not saviors who come to reunite us to God, save us from sin. In this paradigm, they are examples of self-realization, which is the goal of all individuals in Buddhism and Hinduism. And that is to escape the endless cycle of death and rebirth, known as reincarnation, and to merge with the transpersonal sea of awareness, to become one with nothingness. When Dr. Bookman is reborn, his soul is reborn. His memories, his personality is gone. It's the spark of the divine that's in him is reborn. And because he's trapped in this cycle until he can get out of it, until he can get back and merge with this sea of impersonal awareness. Nothingness, they also call it. That's what he wants to do. This is very different than God and an afterlife, okay? We're not going to exist. If this is the reality, we're not going to exist. We want to get back to that place where everything that makes me, me, and you, you is shed. So that all that's left is this spark that's God, who's not God, and that goes back to this sea of nothingness. Okay? This is what the other great religions teach. Okay? Traditional Judaism has no clear vision of the afterlife. And for some strains of Judaism, it may only exist after the physical resurrection. Their Savior hasn't come yet. So for some Jews, when they die, everyone goes to Gehenna. Some of them just say the soul falls asleep because the soul doesn't live after the body. So it's only when their God comes back and resurrects everyone will there be an afterlife. Okay? That's different than what we believe. And Islam. While Islam teaches of an afterlife, and if you blow yourself up and kill a bunch of other people and be declared a Muslim martyr, you get 70 virgins, and you can drink all the alcohol from the river of liquor that won't ever make you drunk, because why not? Islam is merely a poorly cobbled together synthesis of Judaism and Christianity, a very poorly cobbled together of Islam is Judaism, Christianity, and the native polytheism. The native paganism that the Arabs practiced then, and it's put together in this weird mishmash of stuff, okay? And love is not one of the central attributes of the Islamic God. For us, God is love. That's the highest theology, that's the highest declaration of faith we can say. God is love. In Islam, Allah has 99 names. Not one of them is love, okay? So the great religions don't teach the same thing, okay? And that's one of the modern secular humanist ideologies. It tends to reduce all religions to a universal core of shared beliefs and attributes and goals, which in reality do not exist. Okay? It's demeaning to a Christian to say, you and a Muslim, a Christian and a Muslim, or a Christian and a Buddhist, or a Christian and a Hindu, when you strip away all the superficials of you, all you believe the same thing. It's demeaning to us. It's demeaning to them. They would say, no, we don't believe that. I want nirvana. I don't want heaven. Different concepts, okay? Individuals in the contemporary interpretation of near-death experiences, again, from a secular humanist point of view, are not held accountable or responsible after the soul departs from the body. In other words, there's no judgment. There's no being held account. No responsibility. In general. Okay? And there is much talk of changed lives and spirituality and love. And I affirm that. And I say that's good. But at the same time, there's no talk of virtue, of self-sacrifice, of sin, or repentance. Sin not, you know, that we're stuck there, but that we got to overcome sin. It takes more than a positive attitude. It takes a choice. It takes God's grace. It takes a struggle. Okay? There's no talk of that. The soul, the consciousness, the individuality survives physical death and is destined for a wonderful afterlife simply because it exists, not because of its freely determined relationship with God. Okay? I get an afterlife because I get one. My soul's immortal because it is, instead of, it's from God. It's a gift. Okay? And that which can be scientifically or empirically tested and measured and quantified, and we can put in our books, and we can have our studies and our questionnaires, which is good stuff, is not only real, but true. We can accept it without discernment as being true. Okay? So, our strange hybrid. What's being told to us by the people who aren't having these experiences, but by the people who are interpreting them and researching them with good intention. They have a lot of good to say. And again, we're going to start off next week's session affirming the good that they found. Affirming it. There's a lot of good there. And they're making lots of money. And they may not be having these experiences, but they're kind of putting them together and telling us about a worldview, what it says, what the evidence says. If our minds are open enough, what does the evidence tell us that, you know, we need to change our Christian thought? We need to change our belief in Jesus and God and what he tells us in the church and in Scripture. Okay, so here's our strange hybrid as I see it. Maybe I'm wrong, but the soul, retaining its consciousness and its individuality, survives the death of the body. Historically, this is a specifically Christian teaching. Okay? We went through that other great religions very quickly, but especially the Far Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, they don't teach this. When they say the soul, that's not what they mean. They don't mean consciousness and individuality survives. A specifically Christian teaching. The soul retaining its consciousness and individuality survives the death of the body, historically a Christian teaching, and is destined for an afterlife in a, quote, heavenly realm, independent of any responsibility for the actions freely chosen during its earthly life, its relationship with Christ, its struggle against sin, or its acquiring of virtue as commanded in the Christian gospel, saved by a loving and personal God conceived of uniquely in Christianity. The God of the near-death experience is the personal God. The God who loves, who's a person, who loves us as people and has made us. That's the Christian God. So we're saved, the soul is saved by the loving and personal God conceived of uniquely in Christianity, who has been liberated from Christian understanding of doctrine, salvation, and his son Jesus, for an eternal enjoyment of divine love and development towards self-realization, irrespective of the pursuit of Christ-likeness, repentance, humility, or holiness. This is a strange hybrid. They're putting together two worldviews, oil and water, that kind of don't really fit together. Because if the Christian God has been revealed to us in the church and in the Bible, and he says, if you love me, keep my commandments, and then his commandments are written down for us and live for us, and we're receiving them and we live them, a lot of that goes against this. Okay, this is what our contemporary near-death research tells us. Not the people themselves, not people like Norman, but the researchers tell us, even if a few of those poor near-death experiencers say a little something about a place that sounds a lot like hell. There's some things we need to discern. Next week, hell and judgment in near-death experiences. Not as common as what's being reported in these books, but it's there. Dr. Jeffrey Long's book doesn't talk about hell. But you can go on his website, and in the little search window, you can put in H-E-L-L, and a bunch of things come up. Because there is judgment. We are responsible. We're going to talk about that. But what is judgment? You know, these people, again, have a different view of what the judgment of God is. And the judgment of God is his love and his mercy. It's not that we didn't follow the rules and that he doesn't like us. That's not what it is. We need to unpack what that is. Because Orthodoxy has a different vision of judgment and what God's judgment is than a lot of Western Christianity does. Ran a little bit late, but... Any questions or comments or thoughts or concerns? Okay. Thank you.